From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Bing Liu's skateboarding documentary, Minding the Gap, grew out of his skill for getting people to open up.
When I would go to parties and people would do beer bongs in the living room, I'd corner someone in the hallway and like get them to talk about their childhood. You know, and it felt good to know that other people were feeling these things and hiding them, and made me feel less alone.
In American Horror Story, Sarah Paulson reflects on her show's relationship with its fans.
Nobody's watching the show because they're attached to a particular character. That's really a very fascinating, extraordinary thing. They are attached to the show itself and what it's striving to do and what it makes them feel.
All that coming right up.
KPCC podcast supported by National Geographic's Jane, a film by Brett Morgan that profiles legendary conservationist Jane Goodall and the most Emmy-nominated documentary of the year, called one of the best documentaries of all time by Vogue, natgeotv.com/FYC. And the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. The Hollywood Reporter hails it as one of TV's greatest comedies. For your Emmy consideration, nominated for 4 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series.
The new critically acclaimed documentary Minding the Gap starts off as a really beautiful film about young amateur skateboarders in Rockford, Illinois. In the opening scenes, the director, Bing Liu, follows alongside his friends, Kier and Zach, as they glide through a multi-story parking structure. But soon it's clear that Liu is interested in something much deeper than amazing shots of skateboard tricks. Through interviews with his own mother and stepbrother, his friends and their families, the film explores the lasting effects of domestic abuse and what it means to be a man. Here's Zach, one of the subjects of the film.
Your whole life, society tells you, like, oh, be a man, and you're strong, and you're tough, and margaritas are gay. You know, like, you know, you don't grow up thinking that's the way you are. When you're a kid, you just do. You just act. And then somewhere along the line, everyone loses that.
When I spoke with Bing Liu about Minding the Gap, I asked him when he first got into skateboarding and filmmaking.
I started skating when I was like 12 or 13. I broke my arm when I was 14.
Kind of a rite of passage for a skater,
right? Passage. Yeah, no, it was like legitimate. And then, you know, I started making, like growing up, I had friends who had like high cameras, but then I met these kids from the Chicago suburbs and like they were taking skate videos to the next level. They were taking years to make skate videos. And I was like, whoa, I kind of want to do that. And so I was 14, 15, you know, I borrowed some money from my mom. I was working as a dishwasher, you know, saved up some money and got a camera off eBay. And it started out making skate videos, you know, but then I made my first film when I was 17. I emulated the film Slacker, mm-hmm. Richard Linklater's film. I just got sort of the freaks and geeks of my community and, you know, got them together and just improv this conversational, loose structured short together. But it wasn't until I was in my 20s and started working in the film industry that, you know, I really started experimenting with new things. But, I mean, one thing that skating taught me was that, you know, authenticity and originality, like, really mattered. And those are what's celebrated in the community.
One of the things that's very true in the film, as is the community, is that, unlike, I think, a lot of other sports, skaters are a clan. At what point did you start to notice that there was kind of an extended family for you among skaters that represented something that you didn't find somewhere else in your life?
It was always felt, but it wasn't articulated or on the consciousness. You know, even entering my 20s, it was like some people I could talk to about it like that. Other people like hadn't quite really thought of it like that.
Because they didn't have the perspective. When you're in it, you don't have a way of seeing it from the outside.
In order to articulate it, it's like a paradox. Like the more you directly approach it, the more cheesy it sounds. And it's been done so many times like that. It just hasn't really quite gotten it. And I think the trick is that it's not about the skateboarding. It's about everything that happens outside of the skateboarding.
So that is kind of a capsule description of your movie. And you have hours and hours of footage shot over the years of skaters. At what point does whatever it is you're working on change course and become a story about people who happen to be skateboarders as opposed to a film about skateboarders?
Well, I'd done a lot of projects before Minding the Gap, but I was in my mid-20s and, you know, the last short doc that I'd done was about these two Vietnamese immigrants who had both moved to Chicago in 93, and they had dealt with a lot of identity issues and also with a lot of family trauma. But so I was in my mid-20s and I was like, okay, what if we sort of examine skateboarding through the lens of, you know, the things that young people go through emotionally, you know, as they're growing up, and also what they deal with at home. So I went around the country for a year and, you know, interviewed people and started following people. And then a year in, I met Kier, and I was like, oh my God, this guy's fascinating. Like, I saw so much of myself in him because he was just starting the journey of processing these things for the first time, things that had to do with his race. He's the only African-American skateboarder in this group of white friends. Also, his complex feelings of both simultaneously hating and loving his father. And then shortly after that, you know, someone else who I'd actually known a little bit better growing up, Zach, you know, we had lost touch for many years, but then I come back to Rockford and I find out he's about to become his father. And, you know, it was like, this is a trackable story, but also in the back of my head, I'm like, this guy's not really ready for this.
There are some striking similarities in the film about your friends in terms of the way that they were raised or maybe not raised by fathers and father figures and stepfathers. There is a lot of domestic violence in the story that a lot of people, including yourself, are subjected to. When did you start talking about those bigger ideas with Kier and Zach? And was there a different way that they each felt comfortable starting to talk about it?
I mean, the first time Kier and I really did a proper interview, he just sort of revealed everything, and it was like this two-hour conversation.
How did you get disciplined?
I mean, well, they call it child abuse now, but it's not really child.
And he wanted to talk about it. It was the first time he'd ever talked about his father with anybody. His father recently passed before we did that interview, you know, like within that year. And our conversations over the years continue to expound on that.
How bad did it get? Like, did you ever cry?
Oh, of course. Of course. Like, I mean, wouldn't you?
I did cry.
I feel like everybody cried.
With Zach, he brushed off what happened in his childhood for a long time until years into making the film, where he really sort of showed how soft and hurt he was on the inside. And it made me realize, like, you know, that was always there. It was just hardened over more years, because Kier's 7 years younger than me. Zach's 2 years younger than me. So there's a lot that can happen. And I think it just sort of speaks to like how important that time of adolescence is, you know, like how much who you become is formed during that time and how much like the hardening happens over that softness that you were when you were a child.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Bing Liu about his documentary, Minding the Gap. And after that, a chat about the nature of horror with Emmy-nominated actress Sarah Paulson. Let's return now to my conversation with Bing Liu about Minding the Gap. It's an exceptionally personal documentary compiled from 12 years of footage that Liu shot of his own family and friends in Rockford, Illinois. The film focuses on Liu and his two skateboarding friends, Kier and Zach. It explores the ways that their turbulent home lives have shaped how they've grown into adulthood. In this scene, Bing Liu goes with his half-brother Kent on a tour of their family home. He asks Kent about his relationship with his father, who was Liu's stepfather.
I used to judge my relationship with my father based on like a day-to-day basis on how many things I've done to piss him off in that given day. And this day that I was here playing on the computer felt like a good day, that I hadn't done anything wrong. It all went without a hitch. We hadn't talked very much. There wasn't much opportunity for me to do anything bad. But then he just comes in, looks at me. I turn up and look at him. And he just says that I look stupid. And he walks out. And I thought that was the end of it. I was like, oh, well, okay, that's not too bad. But then he comes back in with a pair of, like, meat scissors. And he just grabs my head and starts hacking my hair off.
There are so many stories like this in your film, and they're horrible to listen to and watch. How did that part of the story start to affect you in looking at your own history, your reluctance to talk to your mom, her willingness to share stories? How did that evolve?
Well, I entered the film. I mean, I didn't want to make a personal doc, you know, but I actually feel really comfortable talking about this stuff, I think more so than many of my friends growing up. And I'd relish moments where I could have these conversations about what was going on at home and, you know, our past traumas. But the reason why I didn't put myself in the film at the beginning, at the outset, was I didn't want to make a personal doc. There was a moment in the film where one of my characters, Nina, she reveals to me that, you know, her partner was being abusive. And so that was a really watershed moment because it forced me to rethink what I was doing, you know, on this ethical level. And eventually I reached a point where I was like, well, you know, this is the point where I can go back and show why this is so important for me to dig into this subject, you know, because there's all these issues of privacy that come up when you're telling stories about violence in the home and violence in the family. And I think, you know, I had to toe that line the whole time. There's no script for being able to handle this in an ethical way. So I had to find my own way.
What does that mean ethically about whether or not you intervene, whether or not you do something? What were the things that you were wrestling with?
What I'm speaking to mostly is, you know, what gives me the right to be able to tell this story? What gives me the right to be able to go into this relationship and dig around? And, you know, I had to show that I went through it, that I understand that it's more complex than did he hit her? You know, the question I was answering, the question I was after was sort of bigger than that.
There's a moment in the film where you ask Kier what he's gotten out of making the movie, and he essentially says it was free therapy. And it's impossible to look at this movie and not see you as a therapist, that people are really opening up to you. Did you always have it way with people that they were willing to trust you, that you were a good listener, that you could sit there and really have people open up to you about what was going on deep in their souls?
Yeah, it happened all the time growing up. You know, when I would go to parties and people would do beer bongs in the living room, I'd corner someone in the hallway and like get them to talk about their childhood. And it felt good to help people, but also felt good to know that other people were feeling these things and hiding them, and made me feel less alone. You know, on the plane ride here, I was talking to this 82-year-old woman for the whole ride. And in the middle of it, she's like, are you a therapist? Like, are you a therapist? But it was cool. I mean, we talked about her sex life. It was great. It was amazing. And I think, like, yeah, it helps me. Like, I feel like I want to live in a world where everyone just has vulnerability and everyone, like, ultimately wants to connect. And, you know, so I think maybe it helps me, like, just believe that more or something.
I'm going to be very careful not to sit next to you on a plane ride. This is a intensely personal film, and I think there's a very true maxim about stories is that the more personal they are, the more universal they become. And for people who don't understand skate community, they don't understand skaters, how do you hope they are affected by the film? What kind of conversations do you hope the film starts or change people's understanding of something like domestic abuse?
It's a very complex thing. It's so ingrained in so many areas. Like, you know, it affects women. I mean, there's several women in the film, and it shows, you know, how it affects them and why they stay in these relationships and, you know, the emotional toil that it takes on them. You know, it shows how children learn or do not learn, you know, to continue behaviors. It shows how fathers ultimately rationalize their behaviors. I mean, it's so, you know, there was a lot of things that I expected, sort of, you know, people like really seeing themselves and characters really relating to the film, you know, like really becoming emotional over it. One thing that's been unexpected is that how many new and young fathers have been really affected by it and like really felt a call to become a better father, not just in like this, you know, just being present, but things like how much emotions matter and how much, you know, emotionally connecting to your child matters as well.
Bing Liu is the director, producer, and cinematographer of the documentary Minding the Gap. Bing, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Minding the Gap is in theaters and on Hulu right now. In 2011, FX premiered the first season of American Horror Story, and a number of things followed. Horror fans got a high-quality cable show to love. The Television Academy created the Limited Series Emmy category to accommodate anthology shows like it, and Sarah Paulson became a muse for series creators Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk. Paulson has appeared in all 7 seasons of the anthology series, and in 2016 she won an Emmy for playing Marcia Clark in American Crime Story about O.J. Simpson. She's nominated this year as lead actress in a limited series for American horror story Cult. Paulson's character, who had a history of phobias that had been kept in check, has a breakdown following the election of Donald Trump. In this clip, her young son and wife are trying to soothe her while she loses it.
Is that bad? You win?
Oh, go to hell, Huffington Post! F*** you, Nate Silver! Oh my God, how could they have been so wrong about this?
You have to do your cookie
book. a different kind of horror story.
Oh God, it just gives me the heebie-jeebies just listening to it.
What do you think horror can do that maybe documentary or straight narrative, like a drama, straight ahead drama, can't do when you're exploring themes as complicated as what's happening in the country and about hate and about violence against people who don't look like a lot of other people?
I think you're trafficking in the world of extremes when you're dealing with the horror genre. And I think with that comes a certain kind of immediacy and potency of feeling that I think means you don't have to sort of traverse any area to reach something for an audience. You know, there's no dead space. Do you know what I mean? It's so extreme, and what you have to do to bring it forward is so large that nobody's going to miss it. You know, you're not dealing in the world of nuance, really.
Right.
And so it's unquestionably what it is, like what you're seeing, dripping blood. It's immediate. There's death. There's, you know, or in this case, a different kind of horror, as you say, which is sort of what we're dealing with politically as a nation.
How did Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk pitch not just the idea for the season, but what they wanted to achieve?
I think they were just trying to do something which we had never done before, which was put us smack in the middle of where we actually were, you know, and to sort of probably delve a little too close to the bone in an effort to get people to really sit up and think about, you know, there was a lot of things that were happening on our show that were sort of prescient. They sort of happened we were filming it, and then 2 weeks later, Charlottesville happened. You know, I mean, it was all that stuff with the Proud Boys on our show and this sort of white supremacist storyline that was happening. It was all sort of, we were filming it and then it happened. And it was just, I remember as we were shooting it, there were these moments where I would read it and think, oh, I mean, this is so extreme. I mean, this is not going to happen in our country. I mean, these men sitting around in these, you know, not that we don't live in a world, you know, that gave birth to the KKK, right? So, I mean, it's not that that this kind of thing doesn't happen in America. It certainly does and did, and it continues to be more pervasive than we'd like it to be. But I think when I read it and I thought, how can this be America? This can't be. And I thought it was too extreme. And then, you know, these things were happening all over the country. And I just thought, this is a very, very frightening thing to be spending my time doing.
In a good way. Bad way?
It's, you know, I like to use my whole self. I'm not interested in sort of putting who I am to the side in order to play something. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, particularly here, I had to call forward a lot of things I think I spend a lot of time trying to push to the side. And instead, I was sort of having to sit in the middle of all the muck of the things that I contend with as a human being. My own fear, my own ignorance, there's a lot of that kind of stuff that I had to sort of sit in. I couldn't move to the left or the right of it in order to do the job.
That sounds like that could be exhausting, because not only are you required to do the job of the actor, but the character is going through things that as a person, you're like out of sight, out of mind,
yeah.
Don't want to go there, don't want to think about it. And yet you're, as you say, kind of going into the deep end every hour.
Yeah,
of
but
production.
I signed up for it.
Right, I know that.
I wanted to be there, and I like pushing myself to extremes. I'm not going to tell you that it's not exhausting. I'm not going to tell you that I look better for it. I'm not going to tell you that, you know, my life is enriched by it per se. But I think from an acting standpoint, I feel that I am more aware of where my limits lie and how far I can push myself. And when you don't have the opportunity to really go somewhere in your work, you don't really know how far you can take something. So I think without my experience on American Horror Story, I don't know if I would know in any other environment what I might be capable of, you know.
Coming up on The Frame, more with actress Sarah Paulson, who will make her directorial debut on the next season of American Horror Story.
KBCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Genius Picasso, starring Antonio Banderas in his Emmy-nominated role as Spanish painter Pablo Picasso, one of the most influential and celebrated artists of the 20th century. Antonio and Picasso both hail from the same hometown, Malaga, Spain, where the production spent several days filming, including in the same house where Picasso was born. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information.
And the HBO drama Westworld, Time proclaims it's one of the biggest shows on Earth. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmers' carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld. For your consideration, nominated for 21 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. My guest today is Sarah Paulson. She has an Emmy nomination for her work in American Horror Story, Cult. When I caught up with her the other day, she was actually on a break from shooting the next season of that show, during which she will not only act, but also will make her directorial debut. Over the 7 seasons of this anthology series, American Horror Story has welcomed Jessica Lange, Kathy Bates, Connie Britton, Angela Bassett, and Lady Gaga into the cast, but Sarah Paulson is the only actress to appear in every season. So I asked her how she thinks the show has evolved.
I don't know. It's hard. It's like, to me, it's like staring at a Chuck Close piece, really, really, like with your nose to it. It's very hard to see what the thing is.
We should say Chuck Close paintings, when you look closely at them, are squares made up of different colors. When you step back from them, they are portraits. But when you get closer, they become incredibly abstract.
Just like a mass of dots and you don't have pixelations. You don't really know what you're seeing. And then you step back and you go, oh, look at that gorgeous thing. I mean, what I do know is that I'm a part of something sort of extraordinary. Love it or leave it. Have it. If it means something to you, great. If it doesn't, fine. But it certainly has been something. Something was launched and thought of with a particular kind of intentionality, and they have seen that thing through. And some seasons resonate with people more than that's the kind of extraordinary thing about it. When you start from scratch every single year, you have this opportunity to draw new people in to watch, and you also then sometimes alienate people who really loved a particular season and thought that's what it should be always. And so you kind of have to wrestle with that. And I love that part of what the creators of the show have done is sort of said, that's all part of this. And we're not here to please everyone all the time. And in that and with that particular viewpoint comes great freedom, I think, for them to sort of throw anything up against the wall and say, let's do this. Why? Because we can. And why not? And people who like the show are going to come along for the ride, and the people who don't will go away. And then some of them come back to different seasons. You know, it's a pretty cool, you know, nobody's watching the show because they're attached to a particular character.
Right.
That's really a very fascinating, extraordinary thing. They are attached to the show itself and what it's striving to do and what it makes them feel. And that's, I think, a big part of about why it works.
You're about to direct. When you think about the way you have been directed and what helps you, how do you figure out what you want to do and how you want to treat your cast based on past experience?
I only know what I like from an acting standpoint, which is I really like to be directed. I really like notes. And I don't mean notes just for note's sake. And I always have questions, and I will tell you if I don't agree or if something feels slightly off. But I do. Sometimes what happens is we'll have directors come on the show and they don't give me direction. And I don't know if it's because they think I don't want it or because I certainly know it's not because I don't need it. Of course I need it. I think they assume maybe that people don't want to be told, and they've been playing the character for a long time. But I really like having that help and that that pair of eyes outside of my own, and because I can't see what I'm doing. You know, I could feel that it was particularly connected, and it could be, there's a famous story, I think, about Laurence Olivier coming off stage and thinking he had given an extraordinary performance, and the director was like, no, 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 that one wasn't good. And then he came off another night and was like, that was the worst thing I ever did. And the director said, that was the best thing you ever, you know. And so I always think about that when I try to self-modulate and regulate what I think I'm doing, and is it good or is it right? Because we're working with these different directors all the time, and you don't know what their particular tastes are and whether you would agree with them about, you know. So basically I try to see what they're saying to another actor, and if I agree with that thing and I think, oh, I like that take, I think that's really smart, then I tend to trust them more, you know. So I don't know, I definitely want to talk to the actors, and I want to have I want to be able to give them ideas and suggestions, and I personally don't like to be left alone as an actor.
So what will you, the actor, say to yourself as the director when the actor is lost and the director knows exactly what she wants?
I think I'm sort of might be in a bit of a pickle there, because, you know, I don't like to watch myself. So the only, you know, a lot of people, actor friends of mine who have directed, have said, well, you know, just watch playback on yourself. And I was like, watch playback? I would no more watch playback. I wouldn't be able to tell you anything about what I thought. I would just be like, ah, nose and face. And what's that weird? Why was the inflection that? Oh, God. So I might have one of our producer directors that works with us a lot come there on the days when I'm actually in the scene to manage my situation so that I don't have to, at least for my first time out of the gate directing. I think it might be helpful to have a pair of eyes that I trust to sort of say thumbs up or thumbs down.
More of a macro question. You did this season, which was led by two women. You did the all-female Ocean's 8. Do you think those are exceptions to the rule still? Do you see any signs of progress in terms of who gets to tell stories and who are in those stories?
I certainly look around on my sets, more sets that I'm on, and see many more women than I did in previous years, in all departments. I mean, it's particularly unique in the Ryan Murphy world. He's always had so many women in front of him, behind the camera, always, and is so interested in telling stories, female-centric stories, and a lot of times, female-centric stories that are about women over 40, and, you know, that's sort of atypical and unique to him, and so, you know, the Ocean's 8 thing, that was an extraordinary thing to be on a set with 8 women. I mean, none of us, we all looked around sort of blinking at each other going, wait, what? This is wild. I mean, maybe you have like a sidekick or a friend in a movie when you're a big movie star, like a lot of those gals are. But 8 women, none of us had ever had that experience. And it was really extraordinary. So my hope is that given that there has been such a loud clanging bell around this topic in the last year, that we take that momentum and velocity and continue to do something with it, as opposed to continuing to talk about it. It's like, let's move from the place of conversation to the doing. And I certainly see it. I think prior to this moment in our country's history, in our world's history, we thought we had made a lot of progress, you know? And now you pull everything back and you sort of go, oh my God, we have a long way to go.
Sarah Paulson, great to see you.
Really great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Paulson can be seen in the most recent season of American Horror Story Cult, and you can hear more from her, along with many other Emmy Award nominees, tonight on the Frame Special Emmy Preview. That's at 9 p.m. right here on 89.3 KPCC. That'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.